Welcome to the Alt Animation Podcast, the podcast that talks about the saltier side of the animation industry. I'm Josh Ryan.
And I'm Robert Orndorff.
We've got a really good show for you guys today. We're going to be interviewing Wendy Tilby and Amanda Forbes, Oscar nominees for the short animated category. And we have, you know, I guess you were going to say something else, and I totally jumped on your...
No, that's okay. I think, I mentioned it before, but I think, I was going to say that it's the second now Oscar-nominated... this guy wanted me to toot our own horn, that's why I was hesitant, but it's our second Oscar-nominated animation animator. The first one was...
Jamil Lachlan. Yeah. And he has a really cool post up on his blog now about the behind-the-scenes of Fantastic Flying Books and Mr. Morris Lesmore, where he does some really cool pencil tests of some of my favorite shots, the one where the house is spinning. It's really cool to see him flesh out the animation in, you know, with a 3D environment with a 2D pencil test. So you really have to think about all that when you're doing
it. What surprised you the most, or did anything really surprise you about his process for completing it?
I guess just how much it was fleshed out, how much of the actual movement he had. But, I mean, that's really what you get when you have to show it to, you know, producers and people mm-hmm. who are going for it. But, I mean, it's a really cool process. And, you know, you can always go back and listen to that interview and hear about Jamil's process. He talks about it a little bit. But this week we have Wendy Tilby and Amanda Forbes, and they have been nominated before. We talked about them in the last podcast, but we should be airing this the day of the Oscar nominations, so definitely cross your fingers. Yeah, we're going to release it the day of.
Okay, fair enough.
So definitely cross your fingers for both of them. We hope the best, and, you know, there's a lot of really good competition this year. Pixar, of course, is always the top one.
They're not nominated for a feature. That's right. You want to talk about that?
No. I think we should leave that one be.
Okay.
For the time being. Let's see what happens after the Oscars. We'll talk about Pixar. All
right.
But one of the things that studio, the Moonbot Studio, is doing, the ones that did Fantastic Flying Books and Mr. Morris Lesmore, they are also doing one called The Numberlys, which they did this with the Fantastic Flying Books, which is an interactive iPad app.
Right.
And that kind of leads us to our next topic, which is interactive animation. And Robert?
Yes. Well, I just was going to mention a video I saw on Vimeo. If you search Starry Night, that's apparently with two R's. Starry Night with two R's. Interactive animation. So what they've done is this just like an app for the iPad that it has Van Gogh, however you want to say it, his famous Starry Night painting, except it's sort of in motion. Now, not like so in motion that it stays sort of within its paint strokes so that it's always moving, but the image is kind of the same, unless you decide to alter it. So you have sort of the ability to play with the lines on all this stuff. And of course, after a while, like inertia kind of brings it back to its original state, which is kind of cool too. But you'll see a video of it, and they've put some nice, you know, sort of ambient music over it to make it all seem ultra awesome.
Well, and it's really cool too because he's a painter known for creating motion, mm-hmm. the feeling of motion in a still image, and now you can see what it would look like if it were in motion.
Yes.
And it's really beautiful. It's a really awesome animation to just sit and watch.
And then I think we were talking about it, and you brought up a different one that was sort of, you were like, oh yeah, that's kind of like this, and that's my Josh impression, by the way. Oh yeah, it's kind of like...
Oh, you're talking about this one right here.
Yep. Except, well, they can't see what you're talking
about. I thought you were talking about another piece of art.
Nope.
No. So this reminded me, you know, we talk about interactive animation a lot on the mm-hmm. podcast, and we've covered a bunch, and this is kind of just an addition to the series. This guy, Scott Snibe, or Snibby, I'm not exactly sure how you pronounce his name.
S-N-I-B-B-E.
Yeah, so he wrote this program for one of the original, operating systems, or a while back, it was 17 years ago. It was called Oscilloscope, yeah. And that's
Oscilloscope?
Well, it's two O's, so scoop.
Oscilloscope, ooh,
yeah,
okay.
That's what threw me
off. Yeah, oh yeah, okay.
So he kind of resurrected this program that he wrote a long time ago for the iPad, and it's really cool. I mean, it has multi-touch sensor on it, so you can create multiple shapes. It's more of a motion graphic type animation thing, but anybody can do it. You can make really beautiful interactive animations.
You think in 95 he was like, I wish there was some sort of pad, some sort of...
That was when the mouse was starting to get really popular.
Right, 95.
So, yeah, for him, I mean, that was the first interactive kind of device that you could use. So you know, lighten up,
Josh.
I'm sure that the mouse, it was just as amazing as touchscreen is now.
Good old GUI.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it revolutionized the entire industry, let alone animation.
Folks, if you want to learn more about that, you can try the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley.
That's right. It's a good movie. I love that movie.
Anyway. Well, you forgot to mention, you were talking to me all excited about the thing about Bjork. And
oh, well, yeah. I mean, Bjork came out with this, I guess, new music video / app.
Okay.
And it is all interactive. You can, you know, touch.
Oh, so he didn't make the Bjork one. It's just sort of
He was one of the designers for it. Yeah. So the app is really cool because, and it's a music video.
Right.
With quotation marks, because...
Aren't all her music videos?
Yeah,
music videos with quotation
marks? Some of them are more traditional.
I know, I'm joking.
Spike Jonze's music videos.
We kid.
I love Spike Jonze's music videos for her. They're really cool. But...
I like Michelle Gondry's more.
Yeah, those are pretty good. Those are definitely really good. We should talk about Michelle Gondry sometime in terms of animation.
Totally. We should try to get an interview with him.
You know what movie I saw the other day which reminded me a lot of Michelle Gondry's stuff? And also that the one, Science of Sleep.
Yeah,
was
Science of Sleep.
The Bunny and the Bull. Have you seen that?
I have not.
It's directed by the guy who did Mighty Boosh, and it has the Mighty Boosh characters in it. They're not the main characters, but they're side characters, and it has some really
But they're
cool...
not actually Mighty Boosh characters, they're just the actors, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah,
oh, dude, you're about to make me like walk away from this podcast right now and go find that movie.
Well, I highly recommend watching the movie anyways, because it's a really crazy movie, really awesome premise, really good animation in it, and it's very, you know, some of it's 3D, but it's done in a way that is very crafty, mm-hmm. I guess, what's the word, low...
That might be the word, I don't think there is a word.
Low budget, but...
Gondry-esque?
Yeah, it's to elicit a certain type of dream, mm-hmm. you know, fantasy feel. So some of it's done on the computer, some of it's done in stop motion, and I highly recommend it, The Bunny and the Bull.
The Bunny and the Bull.
But yeah, we're talking about this Bjork app, and it's really awesome. I highly recommend you guys check it out because it's all interactive. So not only are you doing interactive animation, but you're doing interactive music at the same time. So it's kind of a sensory overload experience. But this really cool iPad app that this guy made, I think, is awesome. And it has a really cool story because, you know, it was originally programmed 17 years ago and resurrected into this really awesome iPad app.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's still relevant and cool is, you know...
Well,
it says a lot about the design behind it, because a really awesomely designed program can outlast, you know, a certain amount of time if the idea behind it is solid and unique.
I still like Hyper Studio.
I don't remember that.
You don't remember
Hyper
Studio?
Which one's that one?
Oh, this was going back to the early 90s. It's like a software that let you program little buttons. Like,
oh, you were telling
buttons,
me about this.
And
yeah.
You could also animate, and there was some different stuff you could do. And, you know, like as a, I guess I was like 7, 6 probably. Like, I mean,
crazy.
I was like brand new in school, and they were like, we have these things. It's called a, what is it? Computer? You know?
Yeah.
And there was
You're not that old.
Floppy disks.
Yeah, yeah.
Floppy
true.
Floppies, bro.
They were actually really floppy.
Yeah, we had like computer class, and like we had one guy in the whole school who knew how to use any of them. And besides being the computer teacher, he was basically the IT guy.
Yeah.
And he was like...
Had to know how to use computers back then to really use one. You couldn't just click and start it
those
up.
Those were graphic user interface of, you know, like they were Apple computers. And... yeah, I remember he showed us how to do an animation, then we all had to do one, and by this time I was probably in like 7th before we started actually doing it, or 2nd grade, so it was like 7 years old, but I remember his animation was like a Ferengi battleship or whatever being blown up by the Enterprise.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. That sounds like an awesome teacher.
Yeah. Well, I remember it. It made an impact on me.
Yeah, man, absolutely.
You mean you... And, like, by the end of it, you sort of could make a very, very simple adventure game-style video game. Like Myst, you know? Because you could hide the button. Oh, I remember thinking that was so great. It was like, you, like, click hide, and you'd be like, there's a button right there, and they don't know it, but when they click on it...
It's an Easter egg.
Yeah.
Well... That's a great story from your childhood, Robert. And let's ruin your childhood and everyone else's by talking about out-of-context animation.
Oh.
So you can go onto this blog, which Cartoon Brew just reposted, but it's been around the block in terms of animation circles, but it is a great website.
It's a naughty website.
Yeah, it takes animations, it takes a frame of an animation, and takes it out of context, which... can look extremely
sexual. Oh, that's
sexual.
So awful. They did Lady and the Tramp.
Yeah, it's usually very sexual in nature.
Wait, that's not sexual. That one's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're out of context, so obviously they're not...
They're all wrong in some way.
Yeah, so if you want to go and watch some of the shows that you watch as kids in an out-of-context way, in a very sexual way,
mm-hmm.
It will definitely make you rethink your childhood and might cause some repressed memories to come out.
You might have found a new favorite website, and when your girlfriend's like, "What's this website?" you're like, "Oh, it's an animation website. I wasn't using it for other reasons."
Those are good ones. The ones from...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, all right. Go on these websites and check them out.
Okay. outofcontextanimation.tumblr.com.
That's right. And we'll have all these links on our Facebook page.
You're right.
So check that out. And also on the Alt Animation page as well.
Yes.
So, all right. We're going to go to the interview now. But before we leave you, we're just going to say... Got a very important South by Southwest event coming up. We're going to try to interview as many people as possible for that. So definitely write us. Let us know who you want to hear from and what you want to hear about. Do you want us to tweet live while we're doing it? Because if you guys don't care, then I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to watch.
I mean, whatever.
Yeah. If you're apathetic about it. So yeah, and also follow us on Twitter if you want. Robert's going to start posting up some really funny stuff. This guy, man, his tweets are great. They're really great. And hilarious, timely, and animation related. So
definitely
follow our Twitter page.
No comment.
Oh, and don't forget, after the interview, we're going to have a new Cell Therapy with Kevin Cooper. He talks about the new Team Fortress 2 animations. They're some of my favorite. I love the style and design behind it. So definitely stick around after the interview to hear that. Well, I'm here with Wendy Tilby and Amanda Forbes, Canadian animators. How are you guys?
We're fine. Thank you.
Just dandy.
Well, I was going to ask you, where exactly are you guys located at? You know, what is your home base?
We are in Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Okay, all right. And now, I got to see you guys at the last Auto Animation Festival, which you guys are you know, pretty popular there.
Well, that's nice that you think that. It's sort of our home turf, yeah.
Yeah, and so you guys won the one of the short competitions at the Auto Animation Festival last year, right, with... your short Wildlife.
That's right. Yeah, we won Best Canadian Animation.
That's right.
Surprise. Yeah, that was a surprise.
Really? You had no idea, huh?
Well, we didn't think we were eligible because we weren't in competition.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, so we weren't even there on the final night because we had to get back, and so we didn't even know about it until, I guess, you know, later that night after the awards.
Well, what an awesome surprise that would be.
It was great. It was great, yeah.
Well, I got to see you guys do your Meet the Filmmakers talk. I guess I couldn't remember the exact the phrase that they used, but it was you guys got up and talked about your career. It was a retrospective of what all you've done in the past. And that was really exciting and really cool, and I appreciate you guys doing that for everyone.
Well, thank you. It was, you know, it was so rewarding for us because, I don't know, you guys, the audience, you were just so engaged and enthusiastic. And it was, I think, one of our favorite presentations we've done, because it's just nice to be talking to other animators and to be talking to people who are very clued into what it is you do.
Oh, I can only imagine, you know, not having to water down, you know, what you're trying to say and be able to reach new topics that you wouldn't normally be able to talk about in front of an audience.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, when you talk to a general audience, sometimes they're quite mystified by what it is that you actually do or what you're talking about. So with an animation crowd, it's fun for us.
Well, talking about, I guess, showing you guys off and, making what you do look magical... I just watched a really cool documentary that I hadn't seen before on you guys. It's a short documentary, but on YouTube. That's really well done, and I really enjoyed it. I hadn't seen it until today. That was really cool.
Well, I'm glad you like it. Is that the one for United Airlines?
It was like an overall documentary. It did show the United Airlines spot, though.
Okay, so there were shots of us in stupid little cowboy hats?
Yes, that's the one. I love that.
That's the one.
Yeah, that was really well done. I enjoyed it. So I just want to tell all the listeners, if you get a chance, to go on YouTube and just type in Wendy Tilby and Amanda Forbes, and there's a really cool, you get to see your workspace.
Yeah.
I hadn't got to see anything like that, which it looks like you guys are pretty well organized.
You know, we probably cleaned it up for the shoot.
Well, and you got cats running around too, which is, you know, a sign of a good animator.
Yeah, I think so. That's right. There's always the peril of cat hair in everything. But I think there was a little bit of fakery in that documentary because they actually featured us working under a rostrum camera at one point, which was not actually realistic.
Wow. So what do you guys normally use?
Well, we just have gone digital, basically. That wildlife was painted, you know, with actual paint and then scanned in, and then it just was digital all the rest of the process. But we were scanning instead of shooting under a camera.
Yeah.
And I just want to let you guys know.
It's real artwork, though. Pardon me?
Oh, I was just going to say, I wanted to let you guys know that I really enjoyed wildlife. I thought it was amazing and really well executed and definitely deserving of all the awards it got.
Oh, well, thank you. Thanks, Josh.
Now, and you guys are on kind of the short list right now for the Oscar nomination for that, correct?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll find out on Tuesday whether we're better than shortlisted.
Now, you are nominated for When the Day Breaks. Are you guys, this time around, are you a little bit, I don't know, is it easier or is it tougher? Or what's your process, your thought process on getting, you know, close to a nomination for an Oscar?
Well, it's exciting. I mean, you know, it's such a big hoopla that you can't help but get swept up in it. And it's kind of fun. And the thing that's weird about it is it's such a different world in terms of the digital universe and the internet and, you know, I don't know. It just feels like a much bigger deal this time. There's so much more communication. There's so much more noise on the internet. And so it's a little bit more, I don't know, feels more hype.
I feel like there's as much fuss for the shortlist as there was the last time for the nomination. And it has potential for great embarrassment if we're not nominated, you know, because you have to explain no, you know, because, you know, people read the paper and they think you're nominated and you're not. You're only shortlisted. And so then, you know, we fear that next week we're going to have to be explaining to everybody that no, we're.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah. So it's you get kind of whipped up into a frenzy, which is, you know, we're not complaining, but it's just funny to compare it to 10 years ago. It was quite a different thing.
Well, and if you guys don't mind, I'd like to talk about that for a little bit, just because, you know, the list of people that have been nominated for an Oscar are few and far between. And from what I could remember from your guys' talk, it seems like, you know, once you were nominated, it kind of set off a wave of work where you guys have just been working nonstop since. What's the level of feedback from clients, you know, or even audience that comes from an Oscar nomination? Is it just overwhelming?
Well, it's overwhelming at the time, you know, around the whole nomination time, it's pretty overwhelming. But after that, it just kind of gives you a kind of a legitimacy in other people's eyes that is a nice thing to have, honestly.
Not necessarily warranted.
Yeah. Yeah. Aside from whether you deserve it or not, it gives you a sort of an entree that you don't have otherwise. And, you know, we have had some very interesting opportunities. Some of them we did not capitalize on. But, for instance, the United spots, which were very good for us, came out of that nomination. Because I think for that first round of United ads, they were only looking at Oscar nominees, which, you know, we didn't necessarily approve of that, but that's what they were doing. So that was a great opportunity for us. And then people saw those United ads, and then that provided us with further opportunities.
Oh, I can only imagine, because those were played worldwide, you know, the whole North America section, and it was pretty prominent on television.
Yeah, they were. They were big.
They were interesting because they were 1 minute long, which, as you know, is unusual for commercials these days. So they were little mini stories. So, yeah, it was an interesting campaign. And I guess it's hard for us to trace how much of the work we've had is actually due to an Oscar nomination or not. Because I think that work just sort of begets more work, you know, it kind of, you get a momentum.
Yeah.
And then once you've had a certain amount of experience, it's easier for you to get more work. But, it, you know, compared to, I think, an Oscar nomination in the feature film world, I'm not sure that it makes as much of a difference as that would. You know, it's not, you know, if you're directing a feature film and you get an Oscar nomination, you are on a different map.
Yeah.
For us, you know, we're still in the same little animation world. it's just not quite the same.
Well, and you know, I definitely think there's a lot to be said about the quality of work that you guys do. If you were to be nominated and got a United spot that didn't, you know, play well and didn't sell and people didn't connect with it, you know, the work would stop coming. And I think that you guys just keep on delivering on, you know, what people are wanting, which is awesome.
Well, that's a nice point to make. Thank you. There must be something to that. You're right.
You guys are doing something right.
Well, yeah. We like the fact that the commercial work has been great for us because it's allowed us to jump back and forth between the world of commercials and the world of the National Film Board, which is publicly funded, and it's quite a different what's the word, you know, kind of ammo. The film board is supporting auteur filmmaking. We get to do more or less what we want, or pretty much what we want, and the commercial world is very much dictated by what an agency wants, and it has to be done very quickly. And those are two very different ways of working. And I think having experience in both sharpens our skills and helps us, you know, certainly the commercial work has helped us with our own filmmaking. Hasn't really speeded it up, but hopefully one day it will. But it's good for us to know that we can do things in a timely manner, because with our own films, we're slow. We want to change that, though.
Yeah. Do you guys consistently or constantly go back and try to redo things or tweak? Is that why it takes you a little bit longer?
Does it show?
Well, it does in a good way. You know, it definitely looks like you guys have polished it.
Oh, yeah, God, yeah. We polish it.
Yeah, it's you know, that's partly the, once again, the digital world. The
digital,
you know, the
danger.
The computer, you know, I mean, I'm sure you know this, you know, you can just zoom in and get every bit of cat hair out of there if you want. Whereas if you look at When the Day Breaks, it's absolutely riddled with
filthy
cat hair and cookie crumbs.
Which add a little bit of texture to it.
Yeah. I know, you kind of miss it now that you don't see it anymore. You see a film with a bunch of junk all over it and you get all sentimental about it.
You guys should add that in post later on.
Yeah, that's right.
Overlay.
That's right. There's the cat hair filter in there.
Well, I wanted to ask you guys to talk a little bit about Canadian animation overall, but before I get into that, I guess I was really curious what you guys were talking about the commercial world. I guess when you're going to a place where you have a client, with someone of your guys' stature and your guys' workflow, how much of a revision process is there? Do they come back and say, I don't like this, or change this, or are there storyboards? You know, how involved are they, and how much leeway do you guys have to have artistic freedom in the commercial world?
Well, let's just say there's nothing sacred in the commercial world. they come back a lot, and you know, it's their prerogative, and we just do our best to make them happy. And that's another really good thing about the switch over from sort of working on your own film to working on a commercial, is that you have to give over some of your sort of directorial opinions to give them what they want. And I think that's actually good for you to do that. Just makes you a better person.
It's partly a relief too, because your own opinions can be a tyranny.
That's right.
And you can get bogged down by them, which is, you know, that kind of what we were saying about, you know, tweaking and all that kind of thing. That's the danger when you're working on your own thing. Whereas with the ad agency having kind of the final say, or ultimately the client, it kind of relieves us of that. We do the best we can within the time frame we have, and it's a back and forth thing. But the process is quite regimented, in that the agency can only make, you know, comments within a certain time frame as well, and then they have to sign off on things so that we can move on. And so, you know, if something's completely done and they want to change something, that's kind of verboten. You know, they'd have to pay for it if we've actually already done it and they had approved it. So it's quite regulated in that way.
Okay. Now, if I get too far into the business aspect and you guys don't want to talk about it, definitely stop me. But
okay.
With your clients, with your very specialized skill set and design, you know, aesthetics and everything like that, how do you write up a contract? I mean, do you guys have an agent? Do you deal directly with the ad agency, or do you guys have a filter of some kind?
Yeah, we have a filter called Acme Filmworks that's run by Ron Diamond in okay. Hollywood. And he has a sort of a roster of animators, probably, I don't know, he must have over 100 by now, don't you think? A lot. Close he has to, a lot yeah. of animators. And so ad agencies go to him and they say, this is what we're doing and who do you think would fit the bill? And he'll offer up directors that he thinks are appropriate for particular jobs. Or an agency will come straight to him and say, you know, we like Wendy and Amanda's work and we'd like to work with them. So then what they do is, you know, the way the hierarchy works is you get the client at the top level and then you've got the ad agency and the ad agency's producer and their producer talks to Acme Filmworks producer and then our producer sort of looks after us. And it's actually a very good system because it means you don't have to, it's in the producerial role, it's much easier to look out after somebody else's interests than your own. And if we were like looking after our own interests, we'd be saying, okay, we'll do it again without any kind of, remonstration if they've been wicked or something. Or, you know, if they're asking too much, the producer will go back and say, you're asking too much and this is what you need to do to change.
So they that's so great.
Yeah, they just kind of manage the experience and they make sure that you don't sort of spin out of control on some kind of, you know, egomaniacal fit, which can also happen. And it works really well.
And the producers, like our producer and the agency producer are on every phone call. So everything that is said, you know, gets kind of recorded. So there's no misunderstanding and we never talk directly to the client.
Okay.
That never happens. It's always the agency and we always have our producer in on that conversation. So that it's kind of a protection.
Yeah. This sounds like a perfect system.
It is very good. Obviously things get balled up occasionally, but it helps keep the process pleasant and reasonable. And they also, Acme does a very important service where they, especially if an agency's never worked with animation before, they give them kind of a pre-game talk where they tell them, you know, what the animation process is like and what we expect from them and what they should expect from us. Because that's, you know, obviously where you can land in a heap of trouble is when you're working with people who don't understand animation at all and their attitude is, well, it's just a little thing, just change it without contemplating that it runs over 100 drawings or something like that.
Yeah, like just could you just change her hair a little bit or something and they don't realize that could be a day or two of work to change one little thing. And so they have to understand the process. They have to be educated a little bit to know what they're asking of us.
Well, that sounds, yeah, I think the client is the number one nightmare for most animators. So it's great that you guys have a buffer.
Well, you know, the interesting thing too, is that when we did, I guess it was, either the United or GM or both, we did some spots for GM, but you know, if you're in the same place at the same time for post-production or something like that, you get to hang out with the agency a little bit, the agency people, so the art director and the writer. And when you start to hang around with them, and if they're open enough, you realize that actually you guys we're all probably on the same side, and that it's the client who is liable to frustrate everybody enormously. You know, you may not agree with all of the aesthetic ideas of the agency, but you realize that your aims are kind of similar. Whereas the client, of course, is thinking, you know, is my product displayed prominently enough for at least 14 seconds? Or, you know, they have all their concerns that have to do with the selling.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that the agency's more likely to be concerned with aesthetic.
Well, they're trying to interpret the client's wishes and get that from us. And it might not be to their taste either. So it's
so then they're always trying to massage the client, and it, it can't be easy. It can't. It's, I think they've got the hardest job, actually.
And I'm sure that each project has, you know, brings its own challenges and all of its own uniqueness to the table each time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I was wanting to talk to you guys about Canadian animation because when you think Canadian animation versus animation in Texas, they're two totally different things. So I guess let's talk about that, and we can also go into, I guess, your guys' origin stories and, you know, growing up and how you got into animation and how you fell in love with it in the first place. You know, being from Canada, because it's a totally different world there, and the way that the country treats animation is, in, you know, way foreign compared to what we're used to here, if you guys don't mind talking about that for a little bit.
Sure. Well, it's one fundamental difference that has created the whole Canadian animation culture, and that's public funding. You know, the fact that our government, since wartime...
Second World War...
You know, the film board was essentially created to create or to produce propaganda during the war, you know, in sort of documentaries as well as animation. And Canada being slightly more supportive of, I guess, arts and culture, and, you know, we're clinging to that desperately, but historically that's always been true. The NFB has remained, although it's been eroded a lot over the years. It's the budget cuts come every year, and we're always a little bit worried that the government, the current government, which is conservative, that they might pull the plug completely on it.
Oh wow!
But I can say that it, you know, that and the fact that we have something called the Canada Council, which is sort of a smaller arts funding body. I don't know if
sort of like the NEA,
National Endowment, I guess. Yeah. So things like that have completely shaped the culture, and all the animation that has come out of Canada that has, you know, originated from the film board, which has, you know, allowed animators to sort of try techniques and everything because they've had the luxury of the time and support to do that. You know, right back to Norman McLaren and mm-hmm. like Caroline Leaf and a lot of others, you know, they've really been, you know, the effect they've had on the animation world is huge.
Yeah.
And then that in turn has influenced the independent animation world in Canada as well, just in terms of inspiration and just, you know, creating a culture of animation that's pretty strong. So I think, you know, that really is the difference.
Oh, I can't even begin to explain, I'm sure you guys, you know, would agree with me that, and you just said it too, that the NFB is just a gigantic inspiration, and, you know, animation wouldn't be what it is today without all those experimentations and you know, different filmmakers coming out of that
that's true.
You know, aren't just Canadian animators, they're animators, and they were the head of their time.
Yeah, absolutely. I it's something we're really proud of, and we hope it continues to thrive, but you just don't know. Our current government, you just hope that he hasn't noticed the NFB. It should be said too that though the film board started out as a propaganda machine, that after the war they reset its mandate as an arm's length government agency, so that the federal government does not interfere in content at all. So that means that the film board has produced films in Quebec that are in favor of the separation of Quebec from the rest of Canada. So that's how arm's length they are. And though that makes people mad, I'm really happy about that, because I think that that's really meaningful, that the government isn't getting their sticky fingers in there to tell us what to say.
Oh, can you imagine what type of films would be made nowadays if that was the case?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess one of the things I noticed, and tell me if I'm totally off base here, but when I went there, I had never been to Canada before, and I was just blown away by, you know, the fact that there's government-funded buildings that are art buildings, and that's just a totally foreign concept to me. But I noticed that they had the TAC conference, the Television Animation Conference at Ottawa Animation Festival, mm-hmm. which was all businessmen, you know, all, or from what I could tell.
Yeah.
You know, Canadian animation for TV, films, you know, they're really trying to get their hands into the actual marketable commercial side of it.
Right.
And it seemed to me that that might be, you know, as that's gaining and growing and getting bigger and better, and there's, you know, producing television shows for kids and more traditional mainstream things, that it kind of is taking away a little bit from that art and culture side of it, that, you know, the whole NFB. Is that any, am I right in any way, or am I totally off base there?
Well, they still do such different things, you know, that the what we do, say wildlife, in no way relates to anybody's TV pitch. Mm-hmm. And so there's still apples and oranges. Now, whether that affects the NFB in a negative way, I don't know.
I don't think so. I think there's room for both. And I think it's the commercial animation world exists for a reason, and it needs to exist. It to me, it's fine that it's a business, but it's there has to be room for the other part of it too. I mean, not that I would love to see a kids series for television that had some what's the word? I mean, public funding probably wouldn't hurt it, but I don't know that it's necessary for what its aims are. Whereas the aims of a film like Wildlife, if it had to recoup its money of what it cost to make, which essentially boils down to our time, which was the expensive part of it, because it takes so long. Then it would never recoup its costs. But that is not its aim.
Well, it probably would recoup it. You know, the beautiful thing about those films, I was just thinking about this yesterday, is that you can look at one of Caroline Leaf's films from the 70s, and it's still as good now as it was 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that if you take that into account, the extremely long shelf life of these films, probably if they were being, you know, if they were charging money to see them, then they would recoup their costs. But would take a long time.
Okay, and that kind of, you know, I guess bleeds into another question I wanted to ask you, was the internet, you know, with all this stuff being able to spread a whole lot faster than it used to, you know, with the computers, digital, you know, Vimeo, YouTube, all of that stuff. It seems like there's almost a resurgence of Canadian animation in the rest of the world, because we are, you know, traditionally we had to watch it in some kind of festival or DVD, or, you know, not DVD, but VHS when it came out, and, yeah. You know, good luck finding that. And now if people want to buy obscure or, you know, animation from Canada, say in California, it's not only is it easy to buy off of Amazon or something, you can just stream it.
Yeah.
Is there any correlation between that happening and maybe the, you know, government funding going away, or it, you know, do you think that that might have a hand in it later, where it'll pick back up and, you know, there'll be a whole lot more funding for it later on?
Well, I can't help but see it as a positive thing for the film board, because historically, you know, I used to get sort of, well, we've both had this, anybody who works with the film board has had this, where some vaguely angry Canadian taxpayer will say, well, how can I see NFB stuff anyway? And we would always say, well, you can go to a festival or you can go to the library, you know, mm-hmm. kind of inadequate answers. And now we can say, go to their site, and, you know, they've got this lovely little app for iPhones and...
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't download that.
Nice. And what they're doing, and this is so ambitious, it makes my eyes cross, is they're trying to get the entire collection available to people online, which is...
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah, and that's how it really, really should be. You know, when something is publicly funded, it should be available to the public. And so I can't see it, help but see it as a positive thing. And our film was on... well, it still is, actually, for maybe till tomorrow, on Cartoon Brew. And mm-hmm. Our marketing person was so happy. She said, you know, if we just put that up on the NFB site for a limited time, we'd get 2,000 hits and we'd be happy. And she said, and now we just checked it and it's at 15,000. And, you know, that's a bunch of theaters full of people.
Oh, yeah.
And that's not even a big number. You know, the potentials are so enormous that you've got to see that as a good thing.
Well, and the audience that's watching it, it's not, you know, just, you know, a bunch of people that, oh, hey, it's something to go see. It's very passionate people that are looking for that information all around the world. So not only is it 15,000 people that just saw your film, it's 15,000 people that are passionate about it.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I don't know how that translates into a business model of how people, I'm always a little murky on how people make money on the internet, but in terms of us and having our film seen, it's great. The only thing that I'm slightly regretful of is that the experience of watching something on your computer screen, or even if it's in a, you know, a darkened room with some people or whatever, it's not quite the same as a theater. And mm-hmm. that, you know, the few times, and we haven't seen it that often in a big theater with an audience, but when it does happen, it's just amazingly different.
Yeah.
And, you know, just for us to experience an audience reacting to our film is really meaningful. Whereas all these, you know, thousands of people that are looking at it, we don't quite know how it's going across. Although some people write very nice comments.
And some of them write some not, of them so, not nice. So nice.
But mostly nice. And that's very, very gratifying because, you know, we spend years, you know, working on this thing and you know, what you really want is just to know that it's communicating or that the ideas you put into it are coming out and that people are getting it.
Yeah.
Now that kind of, it makes me remember one of the things you guys said during your talk was that you would mention something about people giving you a hard time thinking that the dogs in When the Day Breaks was rotoscoped. And you said, no, they were the only one, you know, that was one of the things that was actually originally animated. And it made me wonder, did you guys have any kind of negative backlash for having a certain type of rotoscope technique?
No, I think the biggest backlash have been some comments on YouTube. And mostly, actually, the comments on YouTube about When the Day Breaks Again are really positive and that's so gratifying when you just see this big bulk of comments from people who really get it.
Yeah.
It's the occasional person who will say, you know, they cheated. Or, oh, they're not really animators or something like that. And, you know, I mean, you always suppress the urge to write back and defend yourself. But, you know, if we were to defend ourselves, we would say, you know, we're not interested in any kind of animation machismo about who can animate better.
It's a kind of animation purism, I guess.
We're just interested in effect. And, you know, we animated most of Wildlife from scratch. And when I look back at When the Day Breaks, we just went through the artwork a little while ago. And I look at it, and having had a long time away from it, I found it really exciting. I thought it had a kind of a freshness and a something interesting going on in there that was nothing like Wildlife. And so, you know, like I say, we're just not interested in who's the best animator.
Well, and plus, I mean, the When the Day Breaks technique was, you know, there's a way in which you are shaping motion in the way that you are when you're, you know, pixelating, or sometimes even, you know, people who animate with photographs, you know, there's a certain kind of, there's a lot of decision making and how we created the characters from humans. I mean, there was an awful lot of changing of the characters that had to be animated in terms of their shapes and additional features and all that kind of thing. And I mean, we can explain all that, but the fact that it has some video underpinnings for us is kind of irrelevant because I think both Amanda and I were live action filmmakers. When we first went to art school, we were both more interested in that. So we're fundamentally filmmakers, and whether you're drawing every every inch of it from scratch, or you're incorporating photographic material or whatever. It doesn't matter to us. It's about creating a story, creating a look, creating a mood, a feeling. You're still constructing a story. And but you know, I do understand that for some people who are really you know, just live to animate and are very, very good at it, you know, that aspect of it might seem important. The actual quality of the animation to us is, I wouldn't say it's secondary, but it's just one of many things. I mean, we both really admire a good animation, and certain kinds of bad animation bother us, but certain kinds of bad animation in the right context can be kind of wonderful. We kind of like, you know, like stick figure, really clumsy stuff can have a charm that far outweighs, you know, the best Disney animation out there, in my
opinion.
Certainly.
Yeah. Well, and I think all the naysayers, you know, can eat their hat now after watching Wildlife, because nobody can argue with the quality of animation on that. It was wonderful and great and really really unique and you know, really fun.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Well, I guess let's go back a little bit to when you guys were talking about art school, and I guess let's start off, you know, growing up in Canada, the whole culture of animation is a little bit more accepted there. Was it encouraged for you guys to go the art route as kids, or when did you start actually getting into wanting to make animations? I know you did live action, but when did the live action and the art kind of mix together?
Well, I think we both as kids came from families who liked to make art. Wendy's dad is a good painter, and my mother, she was frustrated painter, sculptor, all that kind of stuff. So we came from sort of art positive households. For me, this is Amanda. When I went to art school, I didn't know what I was going to do there. And the first year at Emily Carr College of Art and Design in Vancouver, they have a foundation year where they make you take everything because they know you don't know what you're doing. And a friend said, come on, let's take a film course. And so I said, oh, all right. And it had just never crossed my mind that you could make films. I had no experience with Super 8 or anything like that. So we went into this film course, and I had the kind of light shining down from heaven and angels singing, oh, this is it. This is what I want to do. And then when I got into the film program, I enjoyed it a lot, but I was very attracted to the contained world of animation where you didn't need crews and 3-day shoots in the rain and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of how I got into it. And Wendy?
Well, I kind of went, when I went to art school, which was after university, which was same with Amanda, I was thinking I wanted to make live action or documentary films mainly. And I had kind of an epiphany when I had taken a year off and gone to Europe. And I don't know, I think it was just looking at art over there and just thinking about things and thinking about maybe journalism, but I didn't like the pace of journalism, that you would create something and then it's gone the next day. I just went to art school thinking I want to make films because I want to make films about all kinds of subjects that I'm interested in, and this would be a way to do that, and I could incorporate a love of photography, of writing, of theater, all those things kind of rolled into film. And then when I got to art school, there was a strong animation program there. And I just kind of fell into that. And I liked the solitary nature of it, that working with crews, although it can be fun, it sort of dilutes the process. And like any animator will say, it's kind of about control. I think animators like to animate because they like to control all the elements, and you know, working with music and working with motion and acting and sound, all those things, you're just really at the essence of it, I think, with animation. And I think I discovered that I liked the solitude. I have the patience to do it, even though I didn't think I was very good at it then. I kind of stuck with it, and my graduating film was animation, so I kind of just ended up in the animation world. But
and that's that film was called forgive me for not remembering.
It's okay, Tables of Content.
That's right. That's right. And that led to another one that got you hired at I just read this and it's leaving my mind.
That's okay. Then I went to the film board in Montreal and I made a film called Strings.
That's right.
Yeah. And okay. And Amanda graduated a couple years later and was in Vancouver and also worked with the film board there.
Well, very cool. And you know, your guys' journey is really exciting and really inspiring for at least for me, and I know for a lot of other people I know.
Well, good.
What is your guys' trick, or if you have any tricks or any type of advice for making it a sustainable job? Because you know so many animators that you know they what they do it when they're young and they just burn out, or you know they do it too much, or they just gets old for them, or you know they feel like they're the only people that are still doing it, and then they end up leaving. And it, you know, a lot of people can't make it sustainable, but you guys have for so long. Well, not too long.
That's a while.
What's your secret? Do you have a secret, or is it just the love for it?
Well, it is a really tough gig, and you know, Wendy. At the end of Wildlife, Wendy, we were going to go do post production in Montreal, and Wendy wanted to have buttons printed up that said "Never Again." And you know, every animator knows you can make yourself sick with it. Just the repetition and the pure sloggery of it, and the long, long hours. We had a friend lecturing us yesterday that it was really time we kicked back a little bit, and it feels that way to us. You know, we do work awfully hard. I think one of our secrets is that we support each other, and that you know, in most circumstances, other than when we're disagreeing about something. And even when we're disagreeing about something, it's a huge advantage. You know, I feel like we make better decisions together, that we, one can take over from the other when one is feeling weak and not up to the job. And, these things are so invaluable. So that's kind of an unfair answer.
Yeah, it's kind of lonely. I also think that, to answer your question, that it's a lot of luck, and the fact that, you know, when we came out of art school, this was in the 80s, it was a slightly different climate. I mean, in some ways it was harder because the internet didn't exist and that whole outlet wasn't there. But
well, and animation was nowhere too. I mean, there was no industry. There was no South Park or, I mean, there was
The Simpsons. That's true. But there was, I think the film board was maybe a slightly easier place to get into.
Yeah,
I'm not sure, but I think that I think we're just lucky that we've had, you know, at the beginning of our careers, we had opportunities that allowed other opportunities. It's just we were just in the right place at the right time, and by right place I mean Canada. Mm-hmm. And having had some success right out of art school, I think, you know, it's because we just have people who have just been so supportive of us, and, not everybody does have that, and they're who are just as talented, but, we feel very lucky in that way. But you know, when we get opportunities, we also have to, you know, fulfill them. And so we've been able to do that, but I just think we've been in the right places at the right time too.
Well, but there is more to it in the sense that, you know, that the advice we always give to students is, make a really great film in school, make it the best film you can make. And what's involved in that is being really self-critical, really open to changing things, really open to throwing things out. You know, Wendy is, Wendy's such a perfectionist and she's quite relentless in her pursuit of goodness. And
it drives Amanda a little crazy.
Drives me a little crazy, but it's also really, really valuable. And, you need to be that way. You need to be very open to change. You need to be open to other people's ideas. You can't be precious about your own ideas. you know, it's, you have to be fairly driven, I think. Because if you're not, there's just no way you can stand it, I don't think.
And also, I think for students, it depends on your objective, because everybody's a little bit different. But if you, some students want to get in and get out there and work for a studio in some either technical capacity or as in digital effects or animation. But some people in school want to be directors. And if you want to be a director, like Amanda said, make a film that counts, make a film that gets out there. This is an opportunity to do that without any constraints. It's the next best thing to a film board. Where else can you make a film where no one else is telling you what to do? Well, school is it. And so make that time count, come out with a film and send it out there. And that is the best way, because films get noticed.
And find other people whose work you admire and hang around with them. I think that's another really important thing. A good community and a smart community is just a wonderful asset.
Well, there you have it. That is a perfect recipe for success right there.
Well, yeah.
I was also wanting to ask you guys, you'd mentioned it just a second ago, but when you had worked together on When the Day Breaks, after it was done, was there any type of, hey, let's work on the next thing together? Or was it just an unsaid, we're working from now on together on everything, that's how it is, and no questions about it?
I think it was the latter.
It was the latter. It was kind of an assumption that we'd keep working together, because for us it's quite easy to work together. And it, like Amanda was saying earlier, it's I think we're what is it, more than the sum of our parts.
Yeah.
I mean, it's although our skill sets are, there's a lot of overlap. We do all of the same tasks, you know, both technically and artistically. We do have complementary strengths and weaknesses, so we can kind of, you know, we, for the most part, we fall into certain roles that we know are more comfortable for each of us.
So if one of you won the lottery tomorrow and, you know, said, see you later, I'm out of here, no more animation for me, would the other one continue working?
That's funny. I think that's come up sometimes.
Really, has it? I thought that was a unique question.
I buy lottery tickets.
Mostly because I want a place in Montana, but that's another story. But, when we had a little bit of time off between, after Wildlife, I started really enjoying that because it had been a long time. And I was thinking, that's right, I am fundamentally lazy. And I just haven't had the opportunity to be lazy. So that's kind of my my thought right now. But I think Wendy would keep working no matter what. But we do have an idea that we've kind of got an urge to get going on another short film idea that we probably take on at the film board. So I, you know, the urge is always there, and it is ultimately an interesting and rewarding business.
I don't think we would ever stop. I mean, despite Amanda saying she's lazy, she's creative, and I don't think that money is, you know, certainly not what motivates us. So I don't think it would stop us, but you know, I think money would certainly give us a little more balance in life. That is part of when we're crazy busy on certain jobs, it really is all consuming. And sometimes you think, you know, life's a little short, we should have a little more fun. I mean, we do have lots of fun, but it's
more fun is good.
It's just as you know, I mean, sometimes you can spend days on minutia that is just, it just seems nuts.
Wretched,
you know,
I'm
just,
yeah.
You know, you're just trying to move eyeballs around on characters, and you think, God, this is just a crazy way to spend your life.
Yeah, I would hire animators for sure. That would be my, if I won the lottery, the first thing I'd do is line up a bunch of animators.
Well, you guys are giving me all the right answers.
Oh, good, good. Do we get a prize?
Yes, absolutely. I'll mail it to you.
Okay.
I'll have to figure out what it is. But You know, and you guys have given me a prize, which is the 2005 animation show, which was the first time that I saw the short film that you guys made, When the Day Breaks, and it just blew me away. I loved it so much, and, you know, I guess I want to know what your guys' thoughts are with the animation show, because that was kind of a big deal here in America, you know, a collection of shorts that, you know, you could actually buy and watch, and it had amazing, really cool stuff in it. Did that have any effect on your guys' career whatsoever?
You're talking about the Don Hertzfeld.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it might have. That actually didn't have a the fact that it was included in that was
pretty great.
Was great for us.
Yeah.
Considering, you know, who was putting it together and
yeah.
and all that. Mm-hmm. That was very meaningful. We have no idea actually if it actually had an effect on us, but we definitely. Support that kind of packaging of animation and I'm assuming, was that collection shown in theaters or was it just a DVD?
Oh yeah, it was shown in theaters.
It was.
He did a tour where you know they showed it all around, and you know kind of each theater had a different collection, but most of them were, you know, 80% of them stayed the same. And then the DVD got released in, you know, Best Buy and Walmart and huge name stores, which I thought was kind of funny, being able to go buy NFB shorts in Walmart, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that is exactly what you hope for, because I really do feel that the world is just chock full of fantastic animated shorts and that people are missing out. I mean, that. You know, we're both just utterly convinced of that, that it's a brilliant art form and people just don't see it. And so that effort by Don was a beautiful thing.
Well, and also that model of creating an anthology of short films was one of the first people to do it was, I guess, in the 80s, a guy named Terry Thorne. I don't know if you've heard of him, who created mm-hmm. the animation celebration or called the Tournée of Animation.
Right.
Was the first one, and I can't remember if my student film might have been in one, and Strings was certainly in another one, and that he kind of created that model, and then Spike and Mike picked it up from there, and they were kind of two competing shows. So you'd go to an animation festival and there would be Spike and Mike and there would be Terry Thorne, and they would be hovering around all the animators trying to, you know, looking for the best films and fighting over, you know, who got who for which show. And that was great for independent animators to have this venue. And then the one that you're talking about, because I don't actually know if Spike is still doing it or not.
Last I heard, I think they're not doing it anymore. Although recently I could have swore that I had heard that there was some going around. I don't think it's as much as it used to be, if anything.
Well, the Spike and Mike shows were fantastic when they were at their peak. You know, I can remember going to, you know, one in Vancouver where the place was just jam-packed and there was just this excitement about seeing these films. And again, films that you wouldn't have any opportunity to see otherwise. And they were just, you know, promoting the short film. And like we were saying earlier, I mean, short films are just, you just don't see them. They don't show them before feature films anymore. And they get jammed into, well, in Canada, sometimes they're on TV, but at odd hours or just as filler, something mm-hmm. like that. So they short films are a form that is kind of underappreciated, and there's an assumption that everybody who makes short films wants to make features, that this is just a stopgap occupation until you get your feature deal. And for us, that's not the case at all.
Well, that's refreshing to hear.
Oh,
yeah, I think a lot of people think that.
We don't want to make an animated feature. That sounds like a nightmare to... You know, well, it's like a short story. It's not necessarily, it's quite different from a novel or a poem compared to a novel.
Yeah,
certainly. Oh yeah, like something like Wildlife. I mean, it can only really exist in short form, you know. That and that's the beauty of it.
Yeah, and it's fun. You know, one thing we really like is the sort of distillation process where you're trying to sort out what it is you're trying to say, and B, what is the most concise way to get there. You know, and it is, it's more like prose than poetry, but you know that poets do that where they're picking every word, and it's kind of like that in a way.
Just using economy, like how can you convey the most with the least?
Yeah.
Because you don't have time for backstory and, you know, flashbacks and history and all that sort of thing. So you have to distill it down to the essence.
Well, I want to jump back a little bit. We were talking about, you know, how it's difficult to watch shorts sometimes, you know, like especially if you're even trying to find them, they're kind of on and odd hours of the night.
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, as an animation addict, you know, I am always watching all the new animations and I cannot get enough of it online and, you know, in DVD form and all that. And I've getting to the point where I can't even watch all of the amazing new shorts that are coming out. I don't have enough time in the day.
Yeah.
And what are your guys' thoughts on that? I mean, is there a fear at all of oversaturation of decent animation work? I know that's not a bad problem to have, but what do you think that might mean for the future?
I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of really nice things that you know, a friend of ours, another animator named Deanna Bomsawin, she's always posting her favorite new things on Facebook, and people are producing such cool little films, you know, often under 5 minutes. And I don't know, maybe there's a danger for you getting oversaturated if you're watching them morning to night, but I think probably for people less, you know, less entrenched in kind of animation mania, I don't think there'd be a problem. But
okay.
I don't know, you know, considering how much the world has changed between When the Day Breaks and this film, I just wouldn't even dare to predict what it'll be like 10 years from now.
But I'm always curious to know how many of these people are doing it in their spare time, or how many people are doing it as students, or
yeah.
Are they getting paid for it? Or maybe that's your question, is are all these people going to be able to sustain themselves in the world? And I mean, I wonder that sometimes when we go to animation schools or talk to students, as you look at all these students and a lot of them very talented, and you wonder, where are they all going to go? What are they all going to do? How are they, you know, is there a market for it? Is that your question? You know, kind of.
Yeah. I guess what I'm just thinking about in particular is, you know, how it's changing so fast and how the market is kind of switching over to a, you know, direct from the creator, you know, where somebody like Nick Cross can set up a Kickstarter or, you know, you guys, if you wanted to, could release your own film individually online and charge people for it, you know,
yeah.
Or donations or something. You know, I guess, and like one of you had mentioned, it's, you don't even want to try to predict what might happen because who knows.
Yeah.
But I guess just, you know, what would you think would be a positive future for animation? I mean, would it be good for somebody to just to be able to make their own thing on their own time and then sell it on their own directly to people? Or do you think that the system that's set up now or that has been in the past has merit?
Oh. I don't know. It depends on the personality of the filmmaker. I, you know, we're people who have the luxury of not having to market our own work, and that we get paid, not handsomely by any stretch, but we get paid to make it. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for that, because I hate self-promotion and marketing and fundraising. And, you know, it takes so much energy to make an animated film that I just feel it's almost inhuman to ask people to also raise all the money and then market it afterwards. And I don't, you know, it could be that there's there are great new opportunities out there. There certainly are, you know, the whole Kickstarter thing is quite amazing. But I'm personally happy not to have to deal with that. It's a way to get films done, though. And if you've got the fire in your belly, it's a way to do it. So I think that's a great thing.
Well, yeah, I think that answers my question, definitely. I have one last question before we go.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a podcast a while back, kind of focusing on women in animation, and your guys' name came up quite a bit, obviously. And, you know, we had some responses of people that were saying, hey, you know, we don't want to be considered separate, or we don't want to be have any kind of special treatment or anything like that. Do you guys want to be considered, you know, just animators, or do you want people to focus on the fact that you're women in a very male-driven, you know, creative workforce?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we prefer to just be considered animators or filmmakers, regardless of gender. But I mean, it is an interesting question. I mean, our films are not. I don't think they are using quotations. You know, real women films, like female. I mean, you know how you can look at a film and sometimes you can tell definitely who made it. I mean, maybe you could tell that ours were made by women, but they're not about women's issues or topics, I don't think. Particularly since the last one features a guy, and so they're we don't fit into that category at all. In going back to the film board, I think the film board has nurtured a lot of women animators, possibly even more than men.
We come out of a strong tradition of women animators. It's very cozy in the film board for women.
Yeah,
which is great.
But cool. The world at large, like, you know, when you say a male-dominated world, and it sort of makes me sigh wearily to sort of wonder why that is still. And I mean, I know that in the old days of the studios, only men were considered for animation, and women were only considered for cell painting and rendering and stuff like that. And I think, well, the world, surely, the world has changed so much since then, but I still keep wondering, why is that? Why is it male dominated now? And it is just that, you know, the question of, we always hate to say it, but when we look out at a lot of the women animators that we know, women filmmakers, a lot of them don't have kids. A lot of them do, but I would say the majority don't. And that's you can't change that. You know, it's just one of those things. I mean, we could get into a long feminist discussion about that, but the fact of the matter is that it's really hard to do both. And, you know, women, I think, still do the lion's share of child raising, particularly when they're babies. And,
well, often they're compelled to do it. I mean,
they want to do it.
Apart from whatever, you know, support they're getting from their spouse, they're absolutely compelled to look after the baby first, which, you know, is as it should be.
Yeah.
But,
That would be horrible to have some kind of domestic child issues because somebody is animating too much.
It's a conundrum. I mean, you know, this is not a comment on men or women or anything like that, but it's one of the fundamental conundrums of modern life. And, you know, animation, like we were saying, it's so much work. You know, we just work so many hours in a day, and particularly if we're working on a commercial, where deadlines are deadlines, and sometimes you're working deep into the night. And we've often looked at each other and said, how could we possibly do this if we had children? What do you do? I mean, you're either relying too much on your spouse, or you're paying for childcare, which is not satisfactory for anybody necessarily. And it's a problem. And and it's not unique to animation, but it's just, it is a,
I think it's worse than
a testament to how consuming it is.
You know, the great Canadian short story writer, Alice Munro, I think she had four kids, didn't she?
Yeah.
She had four kids, and she's, you know, made this prodigious output of fantastic short stories. And when her kids were growing up, she did it by getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and writing for 3 hours, but while her kids were still sleeping. And if she were in animation, she'd still need to put another 6 hours in to get where.
That is something that's very unique towards women in terms of obviously having a child. But, you know, I think that's a universal thing for animators is – how do you balance a life and you know, traditional living with a job that is so, you know, non-traditional and so time-consuming and demanding? You know, where's that line?
Yeah, it's hard. We had a friend who was kind of mad at us lately saying, you know, I just feel like I put more energy into this friendship than you do. And we had to say, okay, here's the deal. When we're working in the last couple of years, it's been all out 12 hours a day, and we're tired. And then we go grocery shopping. We take care of basic things, try to get a bit of exercise. And then when we finish, it's time to catch up on all the stuff we've been ignoring, all the socializing, all the dinner party debts, all of the fixing up of things around the house, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so we're never on an even keel where you sort of look at the week ahead and say, you know, I think Tuesday we should have somebody over, and then, you know, another night we'll have somebody else over. We just don't have that kind of predictability in our lives at all.
Weekends aren't weekends necessarily.
Yeah, it's that kind of all or nothing thing. I've succumbed to it to a certain extent, but it's still pretty frustrating. Then, you know, like I was saying, I'm fundamentally lazy. This is hard for me.
Well, and I'm sure it doesn't help having people begging you for an hour-long podcast on your weekends either. I do very much appreciate your very valuable time for doing this with us.
Well, thanks, Josh. It's been fun. Yeah,
and I'm sure I speak for everyone when I say thank you, guys, and we hope you keep on working. You know, definitely take time off for yourselves and enjoy it, but we hope to see your next film, and very best of luck to you, and I would love to see you guys, you know, get nominated and hopefully win.
Well, thank you. That would be nice. Glad you know.
We'll put that out there in the animation sphere.
Okay, thanks for the great positive questions. Vibes. Yeah, thanks for the great questions. Yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Hello, hello, and welcome. You are listening to Cell Therapy, where you get the help you need to satisfy your cartoon addiction. I'm Kevin, your host, and I'm in a very unique place for this therapy session. So far, I've taken you to the networks and onto the web for the past couple of shows. This time, I'm taking you over to the video game space with a series of animated shorts for the popular online shooter, Team Fortress 2. Now, I know you're probably thinking, dude, what the hell, man? But honestly, I wouldn't tell you about it if I didn't think it was awesome. So let's go ahead and get started. This series of animated shorts is called Meet the Team. And they are these really, really well done, hilarious introductions to the characters of Team Fortress 2. So they're named according to the character. So it's Meet the Spy, Meet the Medic, Meet the Demo, Meet the Heavy, Meet the Soldier, Meet the Scout, Meet the Sniper, and Meet the Engineer. There's one that hasn't been released yet, and it's going to be called Meet the Pyro, and that's an introduction into the Pyro class character. They also have an extra one in there that's Meet the Sandwich, which is a food item that you can equip for the Heavy, and it's done from inside the refrigerator. More on that in a bit, though. Now, from what I've read, the videos they were originally intended to get the team, their development team, into the characters and kind of show off the capability of the technology. The first video, Meet the Heavy, is almost a word-for-word script for the voice actor. So they weren't completely intended for promotional purposes, but when it was released to the community received it with this overwhelming amount of praise. So when that happened, Valve, the development or the studio behind Team Fortress 2, Valve, it's spelled V-A-L-V-E. I have to say that because I know I have an accent. But with the type of praise that it got from the community, Valve just they decided to keep on going with the rest of the series and do an introduction for every character. What impresses me the most about these shorts is the quality of animation. This is film quality animation done with game models. Now, when I say quality, I'm not just talking about the visuals. Okay, this is obviously not rendered to the visual perfection of something like Toy Story 3, and it doesn't use high-res character models with millions of polygons. But the smoothness of the movement, camera angles, and storytelling is done to the level of film. And I hope I don't piss any TF2 fans off with this, but I'm not playing Team Fortress 2 because it's an awesome game. It most certainly is an awesome game, but that's not why I got into it. I'm playing it because someone introduced me to the videos, and through that, I got interested in the game. Valve spoke directly to the animation fan in me and ended up getting a sale. What gaming companies used to do was hire an outside production house to do the visually stunning advertisements and cutscenes. Now, since the technology is more advanced, they sometimes use in-game assets and motion capture for the cutscenes. And all of that is hot. I love it. But it does not draw me into the character. A better way to say that is, it makes me want to play the game, but it does not make me want to be that character and do what that character does. Valve accomplishes that because these shorts allow you to get into the character's head. You look at these shorts and these videos and you know exactly who you're playing with when you choose your character. For example, I would normally think that a sniper would be this cold-hearted, sarcastic dude, right? Turns out, he's actually a nice guy that loves his family. That's pretty cool. I'd have a beer with him. And that is what clearly sets these videos apart from anything else. That extra step is the stuff that matters to me. Don't animate something just for the sake of having it animated. Give it some purpose. I'm going to close out with my favorite one of these shorts. Now, I just got done talking about movement, character, story, and all of that good stuff. But my favorite Meet the Team short is the one that has the least amount of animation. Meet the Sandwich. This short is a testament to audio, dialogue, sound design, timing, cause and effect, mood, story. All of the subtle things that are absolutely crucial to great animation and great filmmaking. To kind of describe what's going on, it's mostly audio. This particular short, Meet the Sandwich, it's mostly audio. You hear the scout, the soldier, and the heavy weapons guy talking, but the camera is focused on the sandwich, and the sandwich is inside a refrigerator with beer bottles and stuff around it. That is the entire set with no camera cuts. To give it some context, the sandwich is an item in the game that gives the heavy a boost of energy. So in the short, the scout and the soldier are trying to keep the heavy away from the refrigerator. They fail, and the heavy actually makes it to the refrigerator and eats the sandwich. After that, all hell breaks loose, and the heavy just goes nuts. You hear all of these shouts, screams, and bones breaking. It's hilarious. It's some of the funniest stuff I've ever heard. The reason why I like this so much is because the animation is all reactions to what's going on outside of the refrigerator. You see some shakes and rattling going on from all of the ruckus outside. Then you see the heavy's arm pick up the sandwich. And once he finishes, the fight outside shakes the door back open. All of those little tiny things still tell the entire story without a character performance. That is beyond amazing. See, here's what I think. As students and fans of animation, we are so used to seeing the characters acting that we forget about the leaves and the grass blowing and the water and the boxes and all of the little tiny things. So when you think about it, someone had to animate that. Another great example would be from my favorite movie, The Incredibles. In the beginning of the movie, you see Bob Parr at his desk handling claims. Right after his boss yells at him, he sits back down and a cup of pencils falls off his desk. Someone had to animate that cup of pencils. And that animation is just as important as a character performance. Now, I know you're not going to be in a movie sitting next to your buddy saying, "Man, did you see that branch fall? That was badass." But still, those are the things to look at when you're trying to take your animation to the next level. Now, don't get me wrong. I would love to be someone like Glenn Keane or someone like Bobby Boom Beck. But I also would like to be that guy who has an eye for the subtle details, the tiny things that really help sell a film. So definitely check these shorts out. You can find them by going onto teamfortress.com and clicking on the movies link. If you're a student, study them. Break these videos down so you can take your own work to the next level. Those are going to be the things that take a good animation and turn it into an awesome animation. That's all I got for today, folks. Thanks for listening, and I hope you got the help you need to satisfy your cartoon fix. You can keep up with the show by going over to the website, celltherapy.net. There you can find tunes and topics that are not discussed on the show. Send me an email at celltherapymail, that's celltherapymail@gmail.com. Also follow Cell Therapy on Twitter, @CellTherapy, and tell me what cartoons you're watching. Big, big, big thank you to the Alt Animation crew, and be sure to join me on the next episode of Cell Therapy.